free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, August 1st, 2014. We are wrapping up World War One week today, looking at the long-term consequences of the war, and there were many such consequences. Hope you've enjoyed this week. Today's my birthday, by the way. I'm actually turning 42 today. Oh my gosh, all you Douglas Adams fans will know the significance of the number 42, but anyway, it's kind of depressing, but here I am turning 42. If you want to wish me a happy birthday, the way to do that is to like my page on Facebook. I know that's totally lame, but I don't want you to have to give me money on my birthday, right? So do this. If it'll make you feel better that you're helping me out, making me feel good, go over and like my Facebook page. Don't look for me as Tom Woods on Facebook. Just go to tomwoods.com or tomwoodsradio.com and click like on the Facebook widget. That would make me happy. That's a nice present, I guess, on my birthday. I'm going to be speaking at the Young Americans for Liberty National Convention tonight on my birthday. So I don't know what that means, but I'm going to be enjoying myself. My wife will be there. One of our children will be there with us. So we'll have a nice time. Today, it's Hunt Tooley once again joining us to talk about World War One. Hunt, you'll recall, is a professor of history and chairman of the Department of History at Austin College. He is the author of the book, The Western Front, Battleground and Homefront in the First World War. Hunt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Tom. Great to be here.
I can't think of anyone better to bookend World War One week for us. And of course, it doesn't mean that after this week we can't revisit these topics. There are so many more issues to talk about. I pretty much covered, to one degree or another, the subject of war guilt, the vexed question of war guilt, with Paul Gottfried earlier this year. And I have all my guests for only a limited time, so I want to focus my attention on some other questions. I want to look, first of all, at the long-term consequences of World War One, because there are many disastrous effects that have been sometimes attributed to World War One, and I want to ask you about them one by one. But before I do that, I want to read to you a comment that I received, and I wonder if you might in turn comment on it. Somebody says, I absolutely love World War One week, which is my thing that I invented this week, and think it can't be overstated just how important it is to remind people how horrific war is, etc. And then he said, but the one thing I'd really like to hear is something on the impact that the mass death and economic cost these wars had after they were over. In countries like Germany and France, they lost up to 5% of their populations. What was it like in 1919 with almost an entire generation of the most productive people dead? Were there enough people to fill jobs at manufacturing plants, too many dead farmers to feed the population? What was it like to be in a survivor in a country where all your friends and relatives were dead? How did people continue on? I would imagine a country of hollowed-out, soulless shells of human beings who have lost their humanity. What do you have to say about that, Hunt?
Well, I think it's a terrific question, and whoever posed that question got it all just right in those suggestions. The places that we don't think about so much in thinking about the Western Front or something like that, the places that had very little leeway, very little slack in their societies to sustain those kinds of losses. In other words, people in Eastern Europe, in Southeastern Europe, especially Serbia was in the war for so long, in the Ottoman Empire, these had losses that were just absolutely terrific, and they had economies that could sustain any kind of you know, recovery in any way. There were 100,000 people in Lebanon alone starved to death during the war. There were cholera outbreaks attendant to the campaigns in the Middle East and in other places, widespread dysentery, camp fevers of all kinds. So, yeah, in fact, part of this is reflected in the relief efforts of that are all recorded at the Hoover Institute, sort of headed up by Herbert Hoover. And the Europe that you see there and the Middle East that you see in these pictures of the relief efforts correspond almost exactly to what the to what the question posed. People were dead in huge numbers. The hunger blockade in Germany also had starved to death. Something approaching 800,000 people, civilians, of course. So it was a very, very grim scene. And we add to this the in all the countries with that had something like stable currencies before the war, then we add that inflation, that wartime inflation that was a part and parcel of the war with every single country. In other words, this exploitation of the masses of people, this unjust economic or financial dodge to get money into the government's coffers, that intensified in every country. And so you get this, in the period of the wake of the war, you get also the destruction of these currencies and the breaking of savings. And it was an extremely grim picture. You know, I can also, if I might go on just for a second more, sure. I can also talk about the physical destruction. Just to take, not to mention Eastern Europe, where there was plenty of physical destruction, but in the West, in the Western Front, 300 miles of front, nearly 400 miles, depending on how you measure it. And that front was a swath of land, anywhere from 6 to 15 miles wide, the land that's torn up by the shelling on that stationary Western Front. And after the war, much of that land was deemed so full of poison, so full of dugouts and caverns dug by the soldiers, so full of unexploded ordnance, that much of that land was just simply red zoned by the French or Belgian governments. And that means that it was deemed useless for any purpose. I've talked to some friends of mine, some colleagues who are environmental scientists, and asked them about the number of carcasses of human and animal who were destroyed in the course of the war, and never really taken to some kind of burial. And this also might well have had with what the heavy metals and the decomposing bodies and so forth. This had an impact probably for generations to come. So the scars of the war are pretty deep in a lot of different directions, the physical and economic, and as your questioner suggests, the sort of moral scars are very, very deep.
I want to talk now about what some people attribute to the war, and sometimes they attribute it specifically to Woodrow Wilson's decision to bring the United States into the war, because that seems to have tipped the balance. I mean, maybe it would have turned out that way anyway, but not quite as overwhelmingly as it did. And people will say that as a result of this, you got, for example, the Bolshevik Revolution, you got the Nazis, and you got this and that. Let's take this one at a time. What connection, if any, can you see between the war and the Bolshevik Revolution? Of course, we know that the Bolsheviks probably would not have been able to come to power if they hadn't been able to exploit the war issue. But is there anything else there?
Well, I think so. I think there's some pretty direct effects. For one thing, the Imperial Russian war effort, that is, before the revolutions in 1917, was mismanaged. This was a somewhat backward, huge country, but somewhat backward industrially fighting this industrial war and sacrificing soldiers to make up for the, you know, the lack of artillery and motor vehicles and whatnot. And so, so this was an especially brutal war for Russian soldiers who saw what nearly all soldiers in all armies began to see during the war, that that they were being murdered for some cause that they didn't believe in, some cause of the state that they really had nothing to do with. So the Russian army, especially after the brutal year of 1916, when the Brusilov offensive managed to kill a million human beings, both sides, just in the course of one campaign, the Russian army was demoralized, and this crumbling of the army really, really contributed to the atmosphere of chaos that the Bolsheviks found themselves in. In other words, there was enough instability there that crumbling of the army gave the Bolsheviks a fertile field, although the Bolshevik party was a tiny party. So that's very much, you know, the war contributed in another way. I mean, of course, the German general staff and the German foreign office collaborated to put Lenin into Russia, take him from Switzerland during the war. He crossed Germany with a contingent of Bolsheviks and a bunch of money that was provided by the Germans, and in this boarded up, sealed up train, boarded up so that as they crossed Germany, they wouldn't foment revolution. These Bolsheviks were deposited at the border of the Russian Empire, and so in that very direct way, the war supplied the Bolsheviks to Russia. Since most of the Bolsheviks had been exiles anywhere, a lot of them. So that's important. Lenin made it that way. It was a similar wartime circumstance. And Tom, you know this story very well about the shipping of Trotsky to Russia from New York City. So in many direct ways, I mean, there are these larger issues, but in many direct ways, I think the regime was a precise result. And finally, Lenin took many notes from the command economies of Western Europe, in particular the German Hindenburg program, which amounted to a kind of total war economy. And Lenin and the Bolsheviks, the Council of People's Commissars, when they took over at the very beginning, October 1917, they sat down and said, well, how are we going to run this now that we've taken over the government? How are we going to run the economy? And Lenin said, that's no problem. The Germans have pioneered that. They're the Hindenburg program. So many of these total war kinds of patterns just transfer themselves directly in the case of the Bolsheviks, for sure.
Wow, very, very interesting stuff. What about the development of the Nazi Party and the popularity of the Nazi Party? The usual explanation is that I think there's something to it, that the Nazis wouldn't have had anything to campaign on if there hadn't been a Treaty of Versailles to whip people into a patriotic hysteria. But is there more to the rise of the Nazis that can be set at the foot of World War I?
Oh, I think so, and I agree with you with that beginning assessment, certainly. There are many direct connections, so many we could talk for a long, long time about that, but just to summarize a few, Hitler was a frontline soldier in the war and came back as a kind of veterans candidate. When Hitler first infiltrated the crackpot a party in Munich called the DAP, the German Workers' Party, he was there as an agent of military intelligence, and he found the party so simpatico. It was kind of leftish, but kind of statist, but kind of nationalist, anti-Semitic, kind of socialist. I mean, it had many aspects to it. And Hitler thought, well, I mean, as far as we know, well, I can work with this. And so he left the army and reshaped the party, ousted all the leaders of that existed in that party, and took it over himself and renamed it the NS, the AP. So that's a quite direct connection there. Of course, the war made the early Republic of Germany, and we call it the Weimar Republic, extremely unstable until 1924 or 1925. There were coup attempts from the right and from the left. The war was at the basis of almost all these things. So, of course, the Germans experienced, I've already mentioned inflation, they experienced the great inflation, which wiped out a substantial part of the German middle class in terms of destroying their savings, because, of course, in a hyperinflation, you may have saved $1,000, but if $1,000 can't buy a loaf of bread, then your savings just go up in smoke. So that also contributed, and it was the wartime inflation. It really began at the beginning of the war for Germany, and indeed even a little bit before that, as a result of costs of the military establishment making its way toward the war. But yeah, those are some very direct connections. I think Germans, you've covered the war guilt clause already, but I think that this impacted the way people felt. They thought, well, you know, the other powers were in this war too. Other people fought this war too. Why do we get all the blame? And that's how it was sold, of course, by the German government. The government papers in the 20s wanted to drill that in even more, because, you know, governments don't want, the state doesn't want responsibility. So it loaded this responsibility onto others. Germans have paid higher taxes because of the reparation payments in Germany. So in the economic chaos, and there was economic chaos in the Weimar Republic, which lasted from 1919 to 1933 when Hitler came to power. And in that time, there was economic distress of major proportions up till 1924. Then there are these kind of years. One great historian of Germany has called these the fool's gold years, where things seemed pretty good from 24 to 29 and 30. And then after that, the Depression hit Germany with full force. So for most of the time, the Weimar Republic was economically distressed, and all these things were directly related to the wartime. Now, a fertile field for Hitler, in other words.
Right, no doubt. Now, after the Napoleonic Wars came to a conclusion, the Congress of Vienna treated France fairly liberally. And it seems to be that they believed that if they did otherwise, that France would simply be nursing its wounds and its grievances and its resentments, and it would simply resume fighting in a generation. But then we contrast that with what happened in Paris after World War I, and of course we see the exact opposite, that there are all kinds of double standards doled out against Germany, the 14 points of Woodrow Wilson are thrown aside. Am I comparing apples with oranges, or is it fair to say that the statesmen of Paris were, let's say, not comparable to the statesmen of Vienna?
You know, Tom, that's a great question. And here's a little piece of evidence that really, I think, goes a long way. In the British Foreign Office, in the course of once the United States got into the war and it became clear to the British that they would win. It may be in years, but that they would win. They had one of the diplomats, who was also a historian, they had him put together a study of the Congress of Vienna, because they looked at it and said, well, you know, France, and they told exactly the case that you've described, that France was treated more or less as an equal, and in a few brief years was back in the fold of the great states and all that. And they didn't take a lot of territory away or anything. And the British Foreign Office diplomat was charged with writing a history so that it could be studied, so that that would not be repeated, so that somebody wouldn't get soft at Paris and let the Germans in some way.
Wow, so, I did not know that.
So the comparison is exact. These are two great pieces, and one went one way, and the other quite intentionally went the other way. One of the points of another point of comparison would be that at the Congress of Vienna, the French were there on the spot. They were in the meetings and so forth and so on. And,
right.
But part of that's owing to the great statesman, great crafty statesman Talleyrand and his abilities. But they were there and represented during the Paris Peace. Not only were there no Germans represented at the conference, but no German was permitted to have a visa to come into France during the entire period of the conference, except in very special cases. And in the three occasions when the the peace delegation traveled to Paris to interact for a day or so with the peace conference and then went back. So there is no sense in which the Germans had any representation at the conference except to just go there and receive the results and then come back and respond to the results and then finally to come back and sign the results. So Germans were not even allowed in the country.
That's just unbelievable to me. Well, I know we could do a whole show on this topic, but as our last topic, I do want to just mention something about the modern Middle East and World War I. After the war, you get chunks of what had been the Ottoman Empire apportioned to the various Western powers to be administered by them as League of Nations mandates, presumably on the way to full self-government and sovereignty. How does that affect us today? Is there any legacy to that that remains today?
Oh, I think it's all in the news every day. I mean, our multiple dealings with Iraq over the last 20 years all go directly back to the British mandate of Iraq and their shaping of that. The British also, of course, controlled the mandate of Palestine and Transjordan, the mandates of Palestine and Transjordan. And, of course, if you combine the British, let's say, quasi-colonial occupation of Palestine with the Balfour Declaration that had promised a Zionist state within Palestine, then voila, you have conditions that are just clearly in the newspaper today and yesterday and tomorrow. So those issues very much the same. You get the French in Syria and Lebanon, this pattern of chaos and warfare. You know, the French, there was briefly an Arab king of Syria in 1920, driven out by a French army. And the French ran Syria, and it was not at peace for the next 7 years. There were revolts, there was internal chaos, there were French armies fighting huge battles in the land of Syria. So the impact there was huge. During the war, the British carried out a Mesopotamian campaign that was designed to protect the port/refinery island of Abadan, which is, of course, much a part of modern history in the Iran-Iraq wars and whatnot. And so all of these issues, to tell you the truth, there's pretty much a direct continuum for all of these issues from World War One to today. There's not much of a continuity from before the war because, frankly, under the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire, things were pretty peaceful. I mean, on the whole, our image of the Middle East as a place where people are always killing each other and roaming gangs and murderous dictators and all of that, that's really a feature of the post-World War I period. The period before that, not so much. I mean, we can name some civil wars, and we can name some massacres, and there was religious violence at certain times. But on the whole, for 500 or 600 or 700 years, if you track that back in those empires, there was much, much less killing and mayhem and torture, and the rulers had much, much less power. It was when the state, the modern sort of Western state, that then tried to come in and organize and state build and so forth, when the locals adopted that model, that these atrocious events really came into play. So I think the war is on every page of the newspaper today, just in whether we're talking about Syria, whether we're talking about Gaza, whether we're talking about Iran and its desire to be independent when it was dominated by the British for so long, and so forth and so on. I think it's very much a present kind of thing for us.
Well, all you listeners out there, if you feel compelled, if you feel drawn to learn more about World War One, as we make note of its 100th grisly anniversary, then you can hardly do better than The Western Front, Battleground and Home Front in the First World War by our guest, Hunt Tooley. Hunt, you have done us quite a service. I hope we can come back to you as the months and years go on, as we continue to commemorate 100 years of this terrible disaster.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great work, and thank you for having me, and I look forward to talking again.
All right, everybody, that was World War One Week. I've got a bunch of really great programs on a variety of topics coming up for you guys next week. We got Jay Schaefer from the Tiny House Movement. We got Charles Calamiris from Columbia Business School on bank panics. We got Charles Murray. We got a whole bunch of great programs. Ron Paul's going to be coming back onto the show very soon. So another thing I guess you could do for my birthday is tell somebody about the show today. Link to it on Facebook or tweet it or something. Post something about it on your blog, whatever. But tell the world about the show. That'd be a nice thing to do on my birthday. Thank you guys for supporting the show, for making your Amazon purchases through the Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. Thanks to all you guys who have become supporting listeners of the show, because you appreciate what we're doing here and you like the benefits that you get. Do that over at SupportingListeners.com. All right, another week of programming starts on Monday. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.